Question. Are you completely certain that what you saw resembled a garden and nothing else? Burton. Yes, because I noticed various details. I remember, for example, that in one place there was a row of what looked like square boxes. It occurred to me later they could have been beehives. Question. It occurred to you later, but not at the moment you saw it? Burton. No, because it all looked like it was made of plaster. I saw other things as well. Question. What things? Burton. I can't say, because I didn't get a close look at them. I had the impression that under several of the bushes there were some kinds of tools. They were elongated shapes with protruding teeth, like plaster casts of small gardening implements. But this I'm not entirely sure about. The other thing I am. Question. Did it not occur to you that this might be a hallucination? Burton. No. I thought it was a mirage. I didn't think about hallucinations, because I was feeling absolutely fine. And also because I'd never seen anything like it in my life before. When I climbed to 1,000 feet, the fog underneath me was pocked with cavities. It looked like Swiss cheese. One of the holes was empty, and I could see the waves. In others, there was agitation. I descended into one of these places, and at a distance of about 120 feet, I saw that under the ocean's surface, though only just, there was a wall, like the wall of a very large building. It was clearly visible through the waves, and it had rows of regular rectangular openings in it, like windows. I even had the impression that in some of the windows something was moving. That I'm no longer completely sure about. The wall began to rise slowly and emerge from the ocean. Whole waterfalls of ooze were dripping from it, and there were some kind of things made of ooze, sort of grainy condensations. All of a sudden the wall broke in two and sank so quickly it disappeared at once. I brought the craft back up higher and flew right over the fog, so close I was almost touching it with my undercarriage. I saw another empty funnel-shaped place. It was several times bigger than the first one, I believe. Even from far off, I could see something floating. Since it was light-colored, almost white, I thought it was Fechner's spacesuit, especially because its shape looked human. I made an abrupt about-turn. I was afraid I'd pass the place and not be able to find it again. The figure rose upward slightly at this moment. It looked as if it was swimming or standing up to its waist in the ocean. I made a hurried descent and came so close I felt the undercarriage hit something soft, the crest of a wave, I guessed, since they were high in that place. The person, yes, it was a person, was not wearing a spacesuit. Despite this, he was moving. Question. Did you see his face? Burton. Yes. Question. Who was it? Burton. It was a child. Question. What child? Had you ever seen it before in your life? Burton. No. Never. In any case, not that I can recall. Besides, as soon as I drew closer, I was 40-odd yards away, maybe a little more, I realized there was something wrong with it. Question. What do you mean? Burton. Let me explain. At first I couldn't put my finger on it. It was only a moment later that I realized it was extraordinarily big. Gigantic would be more like it. It was maybe 13 feet in length. I remember distinctly that when the undercarriage hit the wave, its face was a little higher than mine, and though I was sitting in the cockpit, I must have been a good 10 feet above the surface of the ocean. Question. If it was so big, how do you know it was a child? Burton. Because it was a very small child. Question. Does that answer not strike you as illogical? Burton. No, not at all. Because I saw its face. Besides, its body was proportioned like that of a child. It looked to me like, almost like a baby. No, that's going too far. It was perhaps 2 or 3 years old. It had black hair and blue eyes. They were huge. And it was naked, completely naked, like a newborn infant. It was wet, or rather slimy. Its skin sort of shimmered. This sight had a terrible effect on me. I no longer believed it could be a mirage. I'd seen it too close up. It was rising and falling with the waves, but it was also moving independently of them. It was disgusting. Question. Why? What was it doing? Burton. It looked, well, like something in a museum, like a doll, but a living doll. It was opening and closing its mouth and making different movements. Disgusting, because they weren't its own movements. Question. Can you say what you mean by that? Burton. I didn't get closer than 15 or so yards. Maybe 20 would be more accurate. But I already mentioned how huge it was, and because of this I could see it extremely distinctly. Its eyes were shining, and in general it gave the impression of a living child. It was just those movements, as if someone were attempting... as if someone were trying them out. Question. Can you explain that further? Burton. I'm not sure I can. That was the impression I had. It was intuitive. I didn't think about it. The movements were unnatural. Question. Are you trying to say that the arms, for example, were moving in a way that isn't possible for human arms because of the limitations of mobility in the joints? Burton. No, that's not it at all. It was just... the movements made no sense. Normally any movement has some meaning. It serves some purpose. Question. You think so? The movements of an infant don't have to mean anything? Burton. I'm aware of that. But an infant's movements are chaotic, uncoordinated. They're not specific. Whereas these movements, they were... oh, I know, they were methodical. They took place in sequence, in groups and series, as if someone were trying to find out what the child was capable of doing with its arms, what it could do with its torso and its mouth. The worst was the face, I guess because the face is the most expressive part of the body. That face was like a face... no, I don't know how to describe it. It was alive, yes, yes, yet it wasn't human. I mean, the features very much were, the eyes, the complexion, everything. But the look, the expressions, not at all. Question. Were these grimaces? Do you know what a person's face looks like during an epileptic seizure? Burton. Yes, I've seen such a seizure, I understand. No, it was something else. In epilepsy, there are contractions and twitches, while these movements were entirely smooth and continuous. Graceful. You might say melodious. I can't think of another word. And the face, with the face, it was the same. A face can't look as if one half of it is happy and the other half sad, as if one part is threatening or afraid and the other half exultant or something like that. But with this child, that's how it was. Plus, all these movements and facial expressions took place at an amazing speed. I was only there for a short time. 10 seconds, perhaps. I don't know if it was even that long. Question. And you're suggesting that you managed to see all that in such a short time? Besides, how do you know how long it lasted? Did you check your watch? Burton. No, I didn't check my watch, but I've been flying for 16 years. In my line of work, you have to be able to estimate time to the second. I mean, short stretches of time. Becomes a matter of instinct. You need it for landings. A pilot isn't worth his salt if he can't tell whether a particular phenomenon lasts 5 seconds or 10, regardless of what's going on around him. It's the same with observation. You learn it over the years, to take in as much as possible in the shortest time. Question. Is that all you saw? Burton. No. But the rest I don't remember in as much detail. I suppose it was too powerful a dose for me. It felt like my brain was bunged up. The fog was beginning to drop, and I must have increased altitude. I must have, but I don't remember how or when I did so. It was the first time in my life I came close to flipping over. My hands were shaking so badly I couldn't hold onto the rudder properly. I believe I was shouting and calling the base, though I knew the radio was down. Question. At that time, did you attempt to return? Burton. No, because when I finally reached my ceiling, it occurred to me that Fechner might be in one of those holes. I know it sounds ridiculous. All the same, that's what I thought. Since these kinds of things are happening, I thought to myself, maybe I'll manage to find Fechner as well. So I decided to enter as many of the holes in the fog as I could. But the third time, when I climbed back up again, I realized that after what I'd seen, I was in no state to continue. I couldn't do it. I have to say this, and besides, it's no secret. I suddenly felt sick, and I vomited in the cockpit. I'd never experienced this before. I'd never felt queasy. Question. It was a symptom of poisoning, Burton. Burton. Maybe. I don't know. But what I saw the third time, I didn't make that up. That wasn't caused by poisoning. Question. How do you know? Burton. It wasn't a hallucination. Hallucination is something created by my own brain, right? Question. That's correct. Burton. Exactly, but This my brain could not have created. I'll never believe that. It wouldn't have been capable. Question. How about you rather tell us what it was? Burton. First, I need to know how what I've said so far is going to be treated. Question. What does that have to do with it? Burton. For me, it's fundamental. I've said that I saw something I'll never, ever forget. If the Commission determines that what I said is even 1% plausible, such that certain research on the ocean needs to be begun, then I'll tell everything. But if the Commission is going to see it all as figments of my imagination, I won't say another word. Question. Why not? Burton. Because the content of my hallucinations, however ghastly they might be, is my private matter, whereas the content of my experiences on Solaris is not. Question. Does that mean you refuse to answer any more questions until the decision is reached by the appropriate organs of the expedition? You do understand that this committee is not authorized to make any immediate decisions. Burton. That's right. The first transcript ended at this point. There was also an excerpt from a second, recorded 11 days later. Chairman. And taking all this into consideration, the commission comprising 3 medical doctors, 3 biologists, 1 physicist, 1 mechanical engineer, and the 2nd in command of the expedition, has concluded that the incidents described by Burton constitute a hallucinatory syndrome resulting from poisoning by the atmosphere of the planet, a condition in which symptoms of confusion were accompanied by a stimulation of the associative regions of the cerebral cortex, and that these incidents had little or no correspondence in reality. Burton. Excuse me, what does little or no mean? What is little? How big is it? Chairman. Allow me to finish. A separate minority report was filed by Dr. Archibald Messenger, physicist, who testified that what Burton described could, in his opinion, have happened in reality and deserve careful investigation. That is all. Burton. I repeat my previous question. Chairman. The matter is simple. Little means that certain real phenomena could have triggered your hallucinations, Burton. On the windy night, the most normal person in the world can mistake a swaying bush for a human figure, all the more so on an alien planet, when the observer's mind is affected by poison. This is no affront to you, Burton. In light of the proceeding, what is your decision? Burton. First, I'd like to know the consequences of Dr. Messenger's minority report. Chairman. Practically speaking, there are none. That is to say, no investigation will be undertaken in that regard. Burton. Is what we're saying going to be transcribed? Chairman. Yes. Burton. In that case, I wish to say that in my view, the Commission's decision is an affront not to me, I'm not important here, but to the spirit of this expedition. As I stated the first time, I will not respond to further questions. Chairman. Is that all? Burton. Yes. But I would like to talk with Dr. Messenger. Is that possible? Chairman. Of course. That was the end of the second transcript. At the bottom of page, there was a note in small print reporting that the following day, Dr. Messenger met with Burton and spoke with him privately for almost 3 hours, after which he wrote to the expeditionary board, calling once again for an inquiry into the pilot's testimony. He stated that this was necessitated by additional new data given to him by Burton, which he could reveal only if the board agreed to the inquiry. The board, comprising Shanahan, Timilis, and Traheer, turned down the request, and the matter was closed. The book also contained a photocopy of 1 page of a letter found in Messenger's papers after he died. It was probably a rough draft. Ravincer had been unable to determine whether the letter itself had been sent or what its consequences had been. The text began, "Their colossal obtuseness. Out of concern for its authority, the board, and specifically Shanahan and Timilis," Traheer's voice didn't count, "rejected my demands. Now I'm appealing directly to the Institute. But you yourself know such a protest is ineffectual. I'm bound by my word, so unfortunately I can't tell you what Burton told me. The board's decision was, of course, influenced by the fact that the revelations had come from a person with no academic standing, though a good many researchers would have envied that pilot his presence of mind and gift for observation. Please send me the following by return mail. 1. Fechner's bio information, including his childhood. 2. Anything you know about his family and family matters. I gather he left behind a small child. 3. The topography of the region in which he grew up. I'd also like to give you my own take on all this. As you know, a short time after Fechner and Carucci set out, in the center of the red sun, a spot appeared whose corpuscular radiation shut down radio communication, especially, according to data from the satellite, in the southern hemisphere. In other words, where our base was. Of all the search parties, Fechner and Carucci went furthest from the base. The whole time we'd been on the planet, up until the day of the accident, we had never seen such dense, stubbornly lingering fog, accompanied by complete silence. I think that what Burton saw was part of an Operation Human being carried out by the viscous monster. The actual source of all the formations seen by Burton was Fechner, was his brain, in the course of some mental autopsy unimaginable to us. This was an experimental recreation, a reconstruction of certain traces in his memory, probably those that were most enduring. I know this sounds fantastical. I know I could be wrong. So I'm asking you for help. I'm presently on Alaric, where I'll be waiting for your response. Yours, A. It had gotten so dark I was barely able to read. The book turned gray in my hands. The print began to melt away before my eyes, but the blank space below the text showed I had come to the end of the story, which in light of my own experiences I regarded as highly plausible. I turned toward the window. Outside there was a deep purple, a few clouds smoldering above the horizon like dying embers. The ocean was invisible, swathed in darkness. I heard the subdued flutter of the paper strips over the vents. The heated air, with its faint taste of ozone, had grown lifeless. An absolute silence filled the entire station. I thought to myself that in our decision to remain, there was nothing heroic. The time of valiant planetary struggles, fearless expeditions, terrible deaths like that of Fechner, the ocean's first victim, this era had come to an end long ago. I no longer really cared who had visited Snout or Sartorius. After a time, I thought, we'll stop feeling embarrassed and hiding ourselves away. If we won't be able to get rid of our guests, we'll grow used to them, and we'll live with them. And if their creator changes the rules of the game, we'll adapt to the new ones, even if, for a while, we'll kick against the pricks, raise a storm. One or another of us might even commit suicide, but in the end, the new state of affairs will also reach equilibrium. The room was filling with a darkness ever more like that on Earth. The only lighter places now were the white shapes of the wash basin and the mirror. I stood up, felt for the wad of cotton wool on the shelf, moistened a ball of it, and wiped my face. Then I lay down on my back on the bunk. Somewhere overhead, the vent thrummed and fell silent in turn, sounding like a fluttering moth. I couldn't even make out the window. Everything was taken over by blackness. A glimmering streak from who knew where was hovering before me. I couldn't tell whether it was on the wall or far away in the barrenness beyond the window. I recalled how horrified I'd been at the empty gaze of the Solarian space the previous evening, and I almost smiled. I wasn't afraid of it. I wasn't afraid of anything. I brought my wrist close to my eyes. The face of my watch lit up with its phosphorescent ring of figures. In an hour, the blue sun would rise. I reveled in the pervasive darkness. I was breathing deeply, liberated from all thoughts. At a certain moment, when I moved, I felt the shape of the tape recorder against my hip. That's right, Gibarion, his voice recorded on tape. It didn't even occur to me to bring him back to life to hear what he had to say. That was all I could have done for him. I took out the recorder to stow it under the bunk. I heard a rustle and the faint creak of the door opening. "Chris," came a soft voice, almost a whisper. "Are you there, Chris? It's so dark." "Don't mind that," I said. "Don't be afraid. Come here." Chapter 7, Deliberations. I was lying on my back without a thought, her head on my shoulder. The darkness filling the room was becoming populated. I could hear steps. The walls were disappearing. Something was towering over me, bigger and bigger, endless. I was penetrated through and through, embraced without being touched. I froze still in the darkness, feeling its acute transparency that was displacing the air. I could hear a heart very far away, I focused my whole attention, all the strength I had left, on expecting death throes. They didn't come. I just kept shrinking, while the unseen sky, the unseen horizons, the emptiness, devoid of shapes, clouds, stars, drawing back and swelling, was making me its center. I strove to crawl into the thing I was lying on, but beneath me there was no longer anything, and the darkness no longer concealed anything. I clenched my fists and hid my face in them. I no longer had one. My fingers passed all the way through. I felt like shouting, howling. The room was blue-gray. The furniture, walls, corners seemed sketched in broad, dull strokes, in outline only, with no color of their own. There was the brightest pearly white in the silence outside the window. My body was drenched in sweat. I glanced to the side. She was looking at me.
Is your shoulder numb?
What? She raised her head. Her eyes were the same hue as the room, gray, luminous, between her dark lashes. I felt the warmth of her whisper before I understood the words. No. Actually, yes. I placed my hand on her back. The touch teemed. I slowly pulled her to me with my other arm.
You were having a bad dream, she said.
A dream? Oh, that's right. Were you not asleep?
I don't know. Maybe not. I'm not tired. But you should sleep. Why are you looking at me like that?
I half closed my eyes. I could feel the small, regular thump of her heart where mine beat slower. A prop, I thought to myself. But I wasn't surprised by anything, even my own indifference. I was beyond fear and despair. I was further on. No one had ever gone that far. I touched her neck with my lips, then went lower down, to the little hollow between the tendons that was smooth as the inside of a seashell. The pulse was there, too. I lifted myself on an elbow. There were no dawns, no softness of light. The horizon was filled with an electric blue glow. The first ray crossed the room like a shot. There was a sudden play of rainbow-colored reflections, refracted in the mirror, in the door handles, the nickel-plated pipes. The light appeared to be striking against every surface it encountered as if it were trying to break free, to burst the confined space open. By now it was impossible to look. I turned around. Hari's pupils dilated. Her gray irises rose to my face.
Is it time for day already?
She asked in a lusterless voice. She seemed half asleep, half awake. It's always like that here, honey.
And us?
What about us?
Are we going to be here for a long time?
I felt like laughing, but when an indistinct sound burst from my chest, it didn't resemble a laugh. For quite a while, I think. Do you not want that? Her eyelids weren't twitching. She was looking at me intently. Was she winking? I couldn't be sure. She pulled the blanket up. On her arm I saw a small triangular pink mark.
Why are you staring like that?
Because you're beautiful. She smiled, but it was only out of politeness, a thank you for the compliment.
Really? Because you're looking at me as if you... as if I...
What?
As if you were searching for something.
Come off it.
No, it's like you thought there was something wrong with me, or there was something I wasn't telling you.
Not at all.
If you insist, then I'm sure that's so. But as you wish.
Outside the flaming windows, a lifeless blue heat was coming into being. Shading my eyes with my hand, I looked around for my dark glasses. They were on the table. I knelt on the bed, put them on, and caught sight of her reflection in the window. She was waiting for something. When I lay back down beside her, she smiled.
What about for me?
I suddenly understood. Sunglasses? I got up and started rummaging through the drawers of the table by the window. I found two pairs, both too big. I handed them to her. She tried each pair. They slipped halfway down her nose. The window shades began to descend with their prolonged grinding sound. A moment later, and it was night inside the station, which had crawled into its shell like a turtle. Going by touch alone, I took her glasses off and put them with mine under the bunk.
"What are we going to do?"
she asked. "What people do at night. Sleep."
"Chris?"
"What?"
"Maybe I should make you a new dressing."
"No, there's no need. There's no need, darling." As I said it, I didn't know myself if I was pretending, but a moment later, without seeing, I put my arms around her slender back, and when I felt it tremble, I suddenly believed in her, though I'm not sure. All at once, I felt I was the one deceiving her, not the other way around, because she was only herself. After that, I drifted off to sleep several times, and kept being woken from my doze by a cramp. My hammering heart gradually calmed down. I held her close, dead tired. She touched my face and forehead gingerly, checking to see if I didn't have a fever. This was Hare. Another, truer one could not have existed. After that thought, something changed inside me. I stopped struggling. I fell asleep almost immediately. I was woken by a gentle touch. There was a pleasant coolness on my forehead. My face was covered with something moist and soft that was slowly being lifted up. I saw Hare's face leaning over me. With both hands, she was squeezing out the excess fluid from the gauze into a porcelain bowl. Nearby stood a bottle of sunburn cream. She smiled at me.
"Boy, did you sleep," she said.
Then as she laid the gauze back,
"Does that hurt?"
"No." I moved the skin on my forehead. It was true. I couldn't feel the burns now. Hare was sitting on the edge of the bunk, wrapped in an orange and white striped man's bathrobe. Her black hair lay spread over the collar. She'd rolled the sleeves all the way up to the elbows so they wouldn't get in the way. I was feeling extraordinarily hungry. It must have been 20 hours since I'd last eaten. When Hare finished dressing my face, I got up. I suddenly caught sight of the two completely identical white dresses with red buttons which lay side by side. The first was the one I'd helped her take off by cutting the back. The second was the dress she'd come in the day before. This time she'd unpicked the seam herself with a small pair of scissors, saying the zipper must have gotten stuck. The two identical dresses were the most terrible thing of all I'd experienced till now. Hare was busy tidying the medicine cabinet. I turned away from her surreptitiously and bit my fist till it bled. Still staring at the two dresses, or rather the same dress repeated two times, I began backing towards the door. Water was still noisily running from the faucet. I opened the door, slipped quietly out, and closed it carefully. I could hear the faint murmur of the running water and the clatter of bottles. Then, suddenly, the sound stopped. The strip lighting from the ceiling illuminated the corridor. A hazy patch of reflected light lay on the door, by which I was waiting with clenched jaw. I held the handle, though I didn't expect to be able to keep the door closed. A sudden tug almost wrenched it out of my hand, but the door didn't open. It just shook and started creaking horribly. Stunned, I let go of the handle and took a step back. Something quite incredible was happening with the door. Its smooth plastic surface was cratering inwards, as if it was being pressed into the room from my side. The enamel began cracking off in small flakes, exposing the steel frame, which was straining even more. I suddenly realized that instead of pushing the door, which opened towards the corridor, she was trying to open it by pulling it towards herself. The reflection of the light curved on the white surface like a concave mirror. There was a powerful crunching sound, and the solid panel, bent to its limit, made a snapping noise. At the same time, the handle was ripped from its mount and flew into the room. In the hole it left, there immediately appeared a pair of bloodied hands that kept on pulling, leaving red streaks on the enamel. The panel of the door broke in two, hung crookedly on its hinges, and an orange and white creature with a livid blue, lifeless face threw its arms around me, sobbing. If I hadn't been paralyzed by what I'd seen, I probably would have attempted to run. Hare was gasping for breath, knocking her head against my shoulder, her hair flying every which way. When I held her, I could feel her slipping through my arms. I carried her back into the room, squeezing past the shattered door, and laid her on the bunk. Her fingernails were broken and covered with blood. When she turned her hand, I saw the palm was chafed to raw flesh. I looked into her face. Her wide-open eyes stared through me, expressionless.
Hurry!
She responded with an inarticulate grunt. I moved my fingers close to her eye. The lid closed. I went to the medicine cabinet. The bunk creaked. I turned around. She was sitting up straight, gazing at her bloodied hands in alarm.
Chris?
She moaned.
What happened to me?
You hurt yourself breaking down the door, I said impassively. There was a feeling in my lips, especially the lower one, as if ants were crawling all over it. I clamped it between my teeth. Hari looked for a moment at the jagged pieces of plastic hanging loose from the frame and turned her eyes to me. Her chin trembled. I could see her struggling to master her alarm. I cut a strip of gauze, took some powder for abrasions from the cabinet, and went back to the bunk. But all at once, everything I was carrying slipped out of my hands. The glass jar with its gelatin seal broke, but I didn't even pick it up. It was no longer needed. I picked up her hand. There was still a faint outline of blood around the fingernails, but the bruising had disappeared, and the palm was covered with fresh, pink skin that was lighter than its surroundings, though the wound was fading almost as I watched. I sat down, stroked her cheek, and tried to smile at her, though I can't say I succeeded.
Why did you do it, Hari? No, that was me?
She indicated the door with her eyes. Yes, don't you remember?
No, I mean, I saw you were gone. I got really scared and...
And what?
I started looking for you. I thought maybe you were in the bathroom.
It was only now I noticed that the locker had been slid aside to reveal the entrance to the bathroom. And then?
I ran to the door.
And?
I don't remember. Something must have happened.
What?
I don't know.
What do you remember? What happened next?
I was sitting here on the bed.
You don't remember me carrying you here? She hesitated. The corners of her mouth drooped. Her face was intent.
I guess, maybe. I really can't say.
She lowered her feet to the floor and stood up. She went up to the broken door.
Chris?
I put my arms around her shoulders from behind. She was shaking. All at once, she turned and sought my eyes.
Chris,
she whispered.
Chris.
Take it easy.
Chris, what if... Chris, do I have epilepsy?
Epilepsy? Dear God, I felt like laughing. Of course not, darling. It's just a door, you know? They have these kind of doors here. We left the room when the outer plating rose over the windows with its drawn-out grinding sound, revealing the disk of the sun setting into the ocean. I headed for the small galley at the far end of the corridor. Hari and I worked together, checking out the cabinets and refrigerators. I quickly realized she wasn't much of a cook, and couldn't do a lot more than open a few cans, much like me. I wolfed down the contents of two of the cans and drank endless cups of coffee. Hari ate too, but the way children sometimes eat, so as not to hurt the feelings of the grown-ups, not exactly forcing themselves, but mechanically and indifferently. The two of us went together to the small surgery next to the radio station. I had a plan. I told her I wanted to examine her just in case. I sat her down in a folding chair and took a hypodermic syringe and needle from the sterilizer. I knew where everything was almost by heart. We'd been so well prepared at the training copy of the station on Earth. I took a drop of blood from her finger, prepared a smear, dried it in the exhauster, and sprinkled it with silver ions in a high vacuum. The matter-of-factness of this work had a calming effect. Hari, resting on the cushions of the folding chair, was looking around the interior of the room, cluttered with apparatus. The silence was broken by the ringing of the internal telephone. I picked up the receiver. "Kelvin," I said. I didn't take my eyes off Hari, who for some time now had been apathetic, as if she'd been exhausted by her experiences in the last few hours.
"You're in the surgery, finally,"
I heard what sounded like a sigh of relief. It was Snout. I waited with the receiver pressed to my ear.
"You have a guest, eh?"
"Yes."
"And you're busy?"
"Yes."
A little examination, perhaps?
What of it? Are you looking for a chess partner?
Give it a rest, Kelvin. Sartorius wants to see you. That is, see us.
Well, that's something new, I said, surprised. What about the... I broke off and added, is he alone?
No, I misspoke. He wants to talk with us. The three of us can connect by visiphone. He's going to cover up the screen.
Is that so? Why didn't he just call me directly? Is he embarrassed?
Something like that, Snout muttered indistinctly. Well, then?
Do you want to set a time? Let's say in an hour, okay?
Okay.
I could see him on the screen, just his face, no bigger than the palm of my hand. For a moment, that was filled with the faint hum of current. He looked searchingly into my face. In the end, he said with a certain hesitation,
How's life?
Bearable. You?
I'm guessing a bit worse than for you.
Could I... You want to come see me? I guessed. I glanced over my shoulder at Hari. Her head hung over the cushion. She was lying with her legs crossed, in her boredom, absent-mindedly tossing up the silver ball at the end of a chain attached to the arm of the chair.
Leave that alone, you hear? Leave it!
I heard Snout's raised voice. On the screen, I could see him in profile. I didn't catch the rest. He covered the microphone with his hand, but I saw his lips move.
No, I can't come. Maybe later. In an hour, then, he said quickly, and the screen went blank.
I hung up the receiver.
Who is that?
Hari asked indifferently. Just this guy, Snout, cybernetician. You don't know him.
Is it going to take much longer?
Are you bored? I asked.
I placed the first of a series of slides in the holder of the neutrino microscope, and one by one flipped the colored switches. The force field set up a hollow drone.
There's not much in the way of entertainment around here. If my modest company isn't enough for you, things are going to get tough.
I said, distractedly elongating the pauses between words, as I simultaneously used both hands to pull the huge black head of the microscope toward me and pressed my eyes into the soft rubber cup of the gleaming eyepiece. Hari said something I didn't catch. I saw from above, sharply foreshortened, a vast wilderness flooded by a silvery glow. On it, in a hazy mist, there lay flat, round rocks that looked shattered and weather-beaten. These were the red corpuscles. I focused the image without removing my eyes. It was as if I were sailing ever deeper into the silvery radiance of a field of vision. At the same time, with my left hand, I operated the crank that turned the stage, and when a blood corpuscle solitary as an erratic boulder appeared between the crosshairs, I increased the magnification. The lens zoomed in on what seemed like a misshapen erythrocyte, sagging in the middle, which already resembled the rim of a rocky crater, with distinct black shadows in the indentations around its ring-like edge. The rim, bristling with crystallized accumulations of silver ions, stretched beyond the edge of the microscope's field. Murky outlines of half-fused, twisting protein chains came into view, as if seen through opalescent water. When I had one such tangle of ruined proteins in the crosshairs, I gradually turned the dial to bring the magnification up further and still further. Any moment now, I'd reach the limit of this journey into the depths, the flattened shadow of a single